hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on podcastufo.com. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And we have a very interesting, different, not the typical UFO show tonight, with Caroline Corey. She's great. I'm looking forward to talking with her. Before that, we have Alejandro Rojas coming up with the UFO updates. And as some of you know, especially the members know because it's on the podcast feed, I went to Shag Harbor for the 50th anniversary, and it was a long, long, long drive. So that show is available for members. It's up in the podcast feed. Members only on this one. So if you'd like to subscribe to the show for $2 or more a month, all that information's on Podcast UFO. If you can't and you really want to listen to that, you can watch it as a YouTube video. And that really goes for all of the shows. The unique part of the podcast that goes in for subscribers only is that it goes into media players, and you can listen to it on about anything out there. So anyway, again, our show is with Caroline Corey coming right up, and right now we have Alejandro Rojas. How are you?
Hello. I come in peace.
Yes, I'm glad you do. Yeah. So how's everything going?
You should be glad, because if I didn't, yeah. Ooh,
I know
you guys would be, this planet would be leveled.
That's right.
Leveled.
I saw your killer dog there a few minutes ago.
Oh, yeah. I was just looking for that cute little guy. I was going to give you guys a shot at our cute little dog, but he walked away, it looked like. So he realized I didn't have food and wandered to scavenge elsewhere, I guess.
Yeah, that happens. That happens.
Mm-hmm.
So what's going on in the UFO world?
So what's going on in UFOs? So you and I covered this story not too long ago of this deputy sheriff from Texas, who said he was driving from Texas to Roswell in 1947, and he saw the crashed Roswell saucer. That's what he claims. And however, some people looked into his background, and you know, they found that he wasn't even a sheriff deputy at that time. Not in, he was, I guess, before then, and then after 1953. So they were thinking, well, it was probably not until 1953 he actually saw this whatever this crash was. But we do have some more details on this. So this was a witness discovered by Irina Scott, who I believe you've had on the show.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So have I. And it was part of her book, UFOs Today, which was published by Philip Mantle. So she's been working with him on this. Well, they did get a hold of his nephew, who said that this guy is a straight shooter. He's not a liar at all. He's not a kidder. He doesn't really have much of a sense of humor. So if he said whatever he said, it was probably true. Then they were able, through him, to get a hold of the son. And the son said that the nephew, I should add, said he never shared that story with him, so he was not aware of this story of seeing this craft. Then they got a hold of the son. The son says the same thing. My dad was an honest person, so if he said this happened, it happened. And they asked him, well, what about the discrepancies there? And he said, well, you know, maybe he didn't remember everything correctly, dates and times and stuff, but I think it was, you know, Roswell that he saw, the Roswell crash. Although he did admit that he didn't know what he saw at first. So his father didn't leave the scene necessarily thinking that these were extraterrestrials and a crashed flying saucer, which kind of says a lot. He was until later, when he was seeing these television shows, that he said, oh, that's what I saw. So I don't know. I don't think this is that strong of a case, but there is some more information that Philip posted today that people can take a look at. Do you remember this?
Oh, yeah. I do. I do remember it, but also, you know, is it a possibility there was another crash? Like, Do I dare say a UFO crash?
I think there's a very real possibility that there was another crash, dare I say a human aircraft that crashed.
Okay.
So I think that is very, very possible, unfortunately. So, yeah, I just don't feel we have anything strong enough to put him there. And then we also don't have anything strong enough to say for sure it was anything even out of the ordinary. Because if you leave a scene, you know, of a spacecraft crashing, I don't think you're going to be like, I wonder if that was an airplane. You know, you would probably be pretty freaked out.
Yeah,
and not only that, he talks about it being on the side of the road, them allowing him to watch for a period of time. And, you know, this crash, if it did happen and it was unusual, well, we know something crashed, but it didn't crash on the side of the highway. It's deep in the desert. I have been there,
right.
And not close to any highways.
I think that was the flag that I mentioned that popped up when you first told the story, was that he was saying it was right near the highway. And
there's
no case at all, you know, when it comes to Roswell, that, you know, the two supposed crash sites had nothing to do with the highway.
Yeah. Well, and Irina's talked to this guy. I'm not sure if Philip has, but they've got a video of him before he passed. He's passed away. And, you know, sounds like by all accounts, he's an honest person, I think. But an honest person, especially once they've gotten older, can make a mistake.
Yeah,
I make them all the time.
Right, right. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about
with me that I make a lot of mistakes. Thanks.
No, but there is a lot of talk about memory, of how memory can change. And like your total memory can change about what you remember. That's why it's so important, if you see something really unusual, to document it right away.
Exactly. Memory is very fallible and malleable. So there's plenty, especially lately, of studies that have gone on where it shows that people's memories are completely manipulated. It's very easy to ask someone about something that happened and their memories. And we know this from talking with family, you know, your parents' story about how you tripped, you know, and in front of the your kindergarten class and cried and ran out of the room or whatever, you know, gets exaggerated and exaggerated more and more. All of these stories get exaggerated, and people are prone to do that. And then these memories are created. So, yeah, memory is a very fallible thing. They find that out more and more. So,
well, someone just said they don't believe you make any mistakes in the chat room. You know, and I'm surprised that no one in the chat room talked about your Denver Broncos shirt yet.
Me making mistakes is rare, despite what my girlfriend says. You know why? And she pointed this out earlier, is because if I make a mistake, I blame it on her. So it was actually her fault, not mine. So that's why I don't make mistakes.
All right.
But yeah, Denver Broncos, they're pretty cool. My hometown. But, and this is the old school. When I grew up, this was their logo. Anyway, other news. So more Roswell news, and this has to do with the alien autopsy. So I think we might have talked about this a bit last week. But to summarize, there was an interview with a guy named Spyros Malaris, and this was kind of the first time he came forward, and it was in a UK paper about a week ago, where he said, "I'm the guy who made the famous alien autopsy film. I'm the one who got all the 40s-style stuff." And he told the story about how he did all of this. It was a fairly short story. Well, not to be outdone, a couple days later, Ray Santilli, who is the most well-known person attached to this film, he's the guy who paid for it to get made and everything. He came forward and said, "No, Malaris is wrong. Sure, it is a hoax video. I've admitted that we hoaxed it, but it was based off of this film that was real." Meantime, Philip Mantle, who we talked about just a second ago, is probably the one who's investigated this the most. He's broken a lot of these stories. He's talking to Malaris before, and John Humphreys, the special effects guy who actually designed the alien. And he posted at openminds.tv a summary of his full investigation. And Malaris is very clear, so is Humphreys. "We did not see any allegedly real film. We made this alien up from our own imaginations." In fact, Ray Santilli had shown them what he said was film of the original film he was provided. And Molaris quickly said that was shot with video. And Santilli got embarrassed and they kind of broke apart. And then Molaris said, hey, that wasn't real, but it would be fun to make a real one and see what happens. We'll make a documentary about how, you know, we have this real footage. And then we'll make a follow-up documentary about how we faked it all and we tricked everybody. Well, they did that. They created the alien and everything. Then they brought Santilli in and said, hey, look, we've created this film that looks real. Why don't we go out and chop this around? So they eventually got a hold of this filmmaker, Bob Kiviat. And the film was shot. They made millions of dollars. Huge success. But of course, at that time, Ray Santilli wanted to continue to push the story that it was not fake. You know, people did discover that the original video was fake or film was fake. And then they tried to pretend that, you know, he had a piece that was real. And then a movie was made by starring a couple comedians in the UK. They showed a little part of this film that was allegedly real. Santilli, again, tried to pretend it was real. But as Humphreys and others and Millaris have said, no, that was all made up. We made that up for the film as well, the movie with the comedians about all of this. Well, Ray Santilli decides to talk to The Sun and do an interview. And he says, you know, I think I mentioned this before, Millaris is completely wrong. Well, he said, here's a little piece of the real film. Here's a image of the real film that he provided The Sun. The Daily Express. The Daily Express posted this image, and very quickly, his name is Scott Brando. He runs a site, UFO of Interest. He tweeted me, and he said, look, that isn't part of any original film. All he did was take a clip from the fake, the hoax video, and he made it a negative, and then he manipulated it with Photoshop to make it look old. And sure enough, he shows them right next to each other, and that's exactly what he did. The Daily Express read our story on this, and so they got their own expert who confirmed, yeah, this is just a Photoshop of a clip from the footage that he has already admitted to have hoaxing. So Santilli's got some more funny business going on here. So Daily Express tried to confront him, and he just won't answer them. He said, at one point, he said he was too busy. One time he said he was driving. They emailed him and said, you know, hey, that you tried to trick us on this. And his reply was 1947. They assume it means it was in response. But he's written about this on the Daily Express, and we have this up at openminds.tv. But essentially it all comes around again that the silly Santilli guy, Freudian slip there when I called him silly guy, but is not to be trusted, that he's a tricky guy and just not to be trusted.
Yeah, so I'll go on the record as calling him a slime ball.
He is a slime ball. I agree with that. So, Millaris, and this is really cool. In our story, Mantle even included some pictures and drawings that Millaris made when they were conceiving of the alien. So you can see these drawings where he's pointing out, we need to make this look like this. We need to make this look like that. Just so he could prove that, you know, this came from our own imaginations. This did not come from any alleged real photos from 1947. And I think he makes a great case. I think that, for me, you know, the autopsy thing was already put to bed, but I think the case for the autopsy being a complete hoax is very strong, especially when the people involved are claiming that also. And he even talks about how he could have gone on with Santilli and they could have made more money together if they would have continued to call it real, but they didn't. I think that that's telling.
Yes.
Couple other short things.
Wait a minute. Before we go there, I just want to say we got Jordan Bonaparte, who I did the show at Shag Harbor with, he's in the chat room, and he says hi, and he says you have some damn nice hair.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, nice thick hair. I'm pretty jealous, not too much.
Really? Yeah, look how gray it is. It gets more and more white all the time, and that's very nice to hear, because my hair does whatever it wants, and luckily I'm lucky right now that it's wanting to look nice.
Yeah,
but a couple other things, stories that are pretty cool, I think, that have been in the news Well, I don't know. With this first one, it is the Roswell slides, the infamous Roswell slides, which you and I have talked at length about, which were, of course, a couple years ago, the slides of a mummy that Jaime Maussan, believe it or not, tried to purport were alien. But he wasn't alone. You know, he put on this event. Richard Dolan was there and was kind of giving him the benefit of the doubt. But the main researchers were Don Schmidt and Tom Carey. And they didn't do very good research because the day after they released a full-on photo, a full-resolution photo, people found out that there's a placard in there that said this isn't just a mummy. So Jaime, of course, is denying that it's a mummy. He still says it's an alien, which is absolutely ridiculous because we know all about this mummy, where it comes from, the whole history and everything at this point. But in this story, it was written by The Guardian, which is another UK paper, but this is not a tabloid. This is a, you know, probably the most respected paper they have over there. But for some reason, they decided to write on this whole escapade. They took it from the perspective mostly of the people who were involved, like Adam Dew, someone I had talked to who was representing the owner of the film, and then Tom and Don. And Tom and Don admit we wanted to believe too badly and we overlooked some information we shouldn't have. But Tom and Don are saying Adam Dew and the film owners, however, did trick us. They didn't give us all the information. Adam Dew is saying, well, no, we did give them the information. We did feel they were kind of taking it a little far, but we didn't know. We're just going with the flow to see what would happen. And you know, I got that sentiment when I had talked to him. I think he was not – he was pretty committed to it being something strange because they thought it was when they looked at it. That's why they sought help from experts, quote unquote. But, you know, it just went bad. So this story is really interesting. It tells the whole story, a couple different things that are added to it. But one good thing even Don Schmidt said was that the media had not caught on this whole thing. And so they were happy that it didn't become a big media thing. And then, of course, eventually, 2 years later, now The Guardian has written about it. That doesn't seem to have really caught on much, though.
That's good.
Yeah, which is good because it just needs to go away.
Right.
And then finally, The Atlantic. This is a cool story. Speaking of Jaime taking mummies and calling them aliens, well, Gaia, which unfortunately is not very careful with their research. In fact, I think their research is awful. It's almost like they like to get hoaxes and call them real, which is unfortunate. But and Jaime does that as well, so I guess they make a good team. But they're trying to purport that these mummies found in the deserts out in like Chile are aliens. Well, no, they're not. And it, as we know, this keeps happening. People keep bringing forth these bodies and then purporting them to be alien, and they turn out not to be because that desert, just the bodies are mummified and they stay in a you know, more intact state longer than other places. Well, The Atlantic wrote a big, long story about this titled "The Racism Behind Alien Mummy Hoaxes," of which it is a genre. I mean, now that's a thing, I think, after we've had so many of them and we'll continue to have more of these alien mummy hoaxes going on. The Atlanta wrote a story about it and just about how the locals are upset that, you know, people keep digging up their ancestors and calling them aliens, which I could see how that would be offensive.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really glad they wrote that story. And hopefully that will stop. It's not right.
It's not right, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, is that all you got this week? Which
it's
is
all
quite
got.
A bit, actually.
Yeah. It was. I know. You're like, is that all?
Yeah, I know.
That was quite a bit, man.
All right. Hey, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
All right. And thank you. Have fun with your interview. Caroline's a lot of fun. I had fun talking with her before. And, of course, all these stories can be found at openminds.tv.
Excellent. All right. Thank you very much. See you next
thank
week.
Thank you.
All right.
See ya.
Bye-bye. All right. All right. So our guest coming up, and I may have just... I think I just hung up on her. Yeah, I did. All right. So our guest coming up is Caroline Corey, and she is a filmmaker, futurist, international speaker, and a visionary author of best-selling books on consciousness and quantum healing. and a very interesting woman, and really happy to have her on board. Hi, Caroline. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Martin. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Just make sure you turn your camera on, if you would. All right. So there you are.
Hi.
Hi. Hi, everyone. And so anyway, thank you for joining us. And so can you give the audience, the listening audience, your background, if you would, please?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I was listening to you chatting with Alejandro, and my background is so different. It's like I had nothing to do almost with the whole UFO ufology, if you will. So my background is with interaction with the beings. So that's how it started out for me. I was 5 years old, and that's the first time that I came in contact with the beings. They just showed up, and we started talking. And so that was my background, in the sense that it was a direct and real experience. It wasn't, did I see something in the sky or not, you know? And so this experience was so real. I remember everything about it. We were communicating telepathically. I remember how that happened, who the beings were. But what happened was, since that time, I started questioning, how did it happen? How did they get here? And so because of that, I started to get into consciousness and the mechanics of the universe and that sort of thing. So that's the reason why I ended up, developing methodology for consciousness and healing and that sort of stuff. So that's kind of my background in a nutshell.
Now, so would you say basically that you would consider yourself an experiencer, or had you had what people are calling an abduction?
No, it wasn't an abduction, because I was never taken by force on a spaceship like that. So I was an experience. I mean, if you call an experiencer someone who's been on a ship or abducted, then I'm not an experiencer. But if an experiencer is someone who came in contact with any non-human entity, then I am an experiencer. So it depends how you define it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. Now, did you talk about this, what was happening, to, say, your friends or your family or anything, or anyone?
Yeah, I actually didn't. It was very spontaneous. I was very young when the first, when it happened. And like I said, it was just kind of natural for me, but I was more into internalizing the process, like, what just happened and how could that happen? And so I never really talked about it. I kept it to myself. And that's probably a good thing, because I think if I start talking about it, then people would be like, parents would be saying, that's not real, don't go there. You know what I mean? So So I didn't really share too much.
Uh-huh. And so how would you say this? Well, you basically already told us, but what are some other ways that this changed your life?
Well, I mean, this has been my life, like throughout my life, I've been communicating with different beings and different consciousness. And so this has been my life. So, you know, I want to say that I didn't realize that it was changing my life. It was just kind of shaping my life in a way that kept me going into wanting to understand how it all worked, who the beings were, how many different types of beings were there, is everybody seeing what I was seeing, that sort of stuff. So it kind of shaped my life in a certain way.
And I guess I'm going to ask you, how long did it take before you actually talked to someone that had a similar experience?
So that was much, much, much later, when when I was an adult and I realized that this was not so common, or at least people do not want to talk about it. So for me, it was normal. So I kind of, it took me a long time, and by the time I started teaching and speaking about it, and I wrote books, of course, then it was more recent, actually, that people were, you know, kind of sharing their experiences. They were telling me what was going on with them. And so then I started to kind of put it in perspective. Okay, these guys are seeing grays and reptilians and stuff, but that's not what I was seeing. So how does that all work? And how are they all kind of all connected, you know, in the universe? And who comes here to do what? So by people sharing their experiences with me, I kind of put it all together, if you will. And I started to then talk about my experiences because I realized they were quite unique and it was adding more information to what was already out there.
Now, where did you grow up?
When I was very young, I grew up in France, but really I spent most of my life, in the U.S. But I also traveled a lot. I lived a lot in Japan and just a little bit all over. But most of my life, of course, in the U.S., in Florida.
The reason I asked, besides I could detect a little tiny, tiny, nice accent, but the reason I asked basically is because it seems like the U.S. has a concentration of, people claiming they're having some type of experience. And I don't know why that is, but it just seems like, you know, I talk to people all over the world as far as this show goes, and it seems like there's a lot more going on here. Not saying that things don't happen elsewhere, but at least people talk about it here.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say is that I don't know if it only happens here, but I think more people talk about it here, you know, because I guess it's more open and it's okay. And there's more, a lot more restrictions, I think, in different cultures and countries, but it doesn't mean it doesn't happen for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, were you able to watch some of the film?
Yes, I did watch it. And I do want to talk quite a bit about that. As we go along, it was really very, very well done, by the way.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Yeah. So when you were young, someone wanted to know in the chat room, they wanted to know more details about what you actually, experienced.
So what happened was I was 5 years old and I was just hanging out there. I was in the living room with, you know, my parents. It was actually Christmas Eve, which was kind of interesting. And so so everybody was busy with like Christmas trees or whatever. And all of a sudden I see this kind of ball of energy. It was just like a ball of light and it was standing right next to me. So I looked around and I was like, Anybody else can see that, you know, and of course nobody was paying attention. So right away, telepathic communication started to happen. So I could hear what they were saying, super clear, and I could also see because I could see subtle energy. I mean, obviously, I didn't know at age five what subtle energy was, but it just kind of spontaneously happened. I could see like kind of the fabric of space, if you will, between me and this consciousness kind of merge. And I could see how the information was traveling from them into my brain and vice versa. So that's kind of how it started. And then they said, we are now communicating telepathically. And they said, the way you do this is you actually condense an entire concept, like you crunch it together. And then they showed me like some sort of symbols. So instead of speaking, you know, like for hours and hours, you just kind of transfer a symbol, and that symbol equals a whole conversation. It's like a zip drive, you know? So, yeah.
Well, that's interesting. I've talked to a number of people that have claimed that they've had some type of communication. And so I've asked them about language. You know, I think recently I had a guest on and I said, what language did it speak in or what language did you hear it in? And it's always their home language. But if it's coming, you know, if it's a one size fits all and code or whatever it is you're talking about. Yes. In your film, I think you said that it's something that's activated within the brain that can communicate.
Yeah. So what happens is that this zip drive, so to speak, is a universal language. It's kind of like it's like the human brain is trained to learn a human language. So when you're a kid, your parents are speaking to you in English, so you're learning the English language, and you're storing these words in your physical, in your brain, not in your physical brain, you know, and then you are retrieving what you've learned to speak. So it's kind of like you're learning the vocabulary and everything in your human brain. But then you are a consciousness, you are a universal consciousness. You didn't come in this physical body from the beginning. You are a universal, kind of you're connected to the universal fabric. And that connection is all consciousness, and there is spontaneous communication. And so this happens in the form of codes. It's literally like a code. And then when you download this code, it opens into your own computer system, if you will, in the language that you understand. So it's not like they're speaking English or they're speaking French. It doesn't work this way. You know what I mean?
Right. I actually this
common denominator is a coded language. And your brain is the one that's translating it into what you understand.
I think it's in 2 weeks from now. I have Randy Nickerson, who I've become friends with over the years. He is doing a film on the Ariel School incident. I don't know if you're familiar with that. But there were witnesses, and there were school kids at the time in South Africa. And they talked about communication, and a lot of them were images. They right. saw images of possible destruction of the earth. But anyway, the short story is that one of the witnesses is going to be on this show in just 2 weeks, wow. along with and I am going to ask what type of communication, if any, did that particular witness feel as though they had?
Yeah, and also, and actually, this is where sometimes things get misinterpreted, because sometimes that coded language, it comes in images as well. And so this is where the human brain kicks in and starts to interpret those images. And depending on what the person, like their preconceived ideas or fears or what have you, this is where the mix-up starts to happen, you know, and where, you know, you are receiving the download, but then your human is also mixing in stuff that wasn't there. That's the problem. Uh-huh. You know what I mean?
There's different people now that have been in the field a long time that have been talking about downloads. For instance, Grant Cameron, which he used to just talk about, you know, the presidents in regards to UFOs. He's talking about this lately, and David Jacobs, who I know is in your film,
right.
You know, speaks about it. So let's talk a little bit about your film in general. You have a lot of science people, and a person that I've been in touch with before, I'm trying to remember, from Stanford that does DNA. Who am I thinking of?
Glenn Ryan.
What is it?
Glenn Ryan.
No, someone.
The DNA. Gary Nolan.
Nolan, that's it. Yeah. Great guy.
Yeah, he's the one that did this whole DNA sequencing on that skeleton, actually. Right. So it was interesting. At least we knew he was open to, you know, getting involved in these sort of topics. So we spoke to him about this film. So what I wanted to do, like I said, so for me, my background was not just seeing UFOs in the sky, because I had very, very direct contact experiences with beings, and also not just that, kind of understanding the mechanics of all of it. I wanted to bring the science of that mechanics to the world, you know. So that's the reason why I wanted to interview scientists in the film. He's one of them. But I also wanted to interview, I mean, in the film you have astrophysicists, you have quantum biologists. So I wanted to approach it from different angles, all from a scientific perspective, to bring validation to this whole contact phenomenon. I mean, I think you know how it is seen from the outside. It's not taken seriously.
Right.
And I think, unfortunately, it is a little bit because of what you and Alejandro were discussing. You know, some people are making things up and, you know, mixing it with the real deal. So that's what happens. And so I wanted to kind of stick to what I really, really know is real, because it happened to me and so many other people, and just bring that science to show it. And I think I did in the film, because we ended up doing on-camera experiments and to show how it was actually possible to come in contact with a non-physical entity. And I don't know, did you get to that part in the film?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right. So what did you think?
You know, I think I try to be open-minded. I try to be skeptical at the same time. And
sure.
And I try to be open-minded because I understand that as I'm going along, I haven't really heard any concrete answers to what is happening. And there's so much more than just the UFO field, which I focus on in this show, basically. But
right.
There's so many more things that are unexplainable. And, you know, I do believe that there is a type of, like, energy connection and between us all. And you know, I mean, it fascinates me, that whole topic. And
there's definitely – sorry, go ahead.
No. And then also – I know that you talk about there's all kinds of theories and thoughts about how UFOs get here, for instance.
Right.
And so I'm always open to hear. I heard you talk about it, and I'm always open to hear different sides. So you're welcome to talk about that as well.
Yeah. So that was another thing. Like I said, one of the questions I had was, well, how did these beings get here? They just like show up, and it was, you know, one of the most intriguing question as I was talking to them, I was like, but, you know, how did that happen? And how are they here physically? Or is this a projection? Or how does that work? And so, you know, with time, I discovered, and I also could perceive, because I could perceive the cell energy, like I said, could see that there is, it's not just a kind of an invisible and abstract energetic link. The actual fabric of space itself, so the space between you and me, even if you're physically here in the room, is not obviously empty. Scientists have been saying that, but it's actually made of specific geometric patterns. So it's kind of like a cobweb. It's very, very interesting, but it's very specific. And so this kind of geometric pattern, this hologram, literally connects you and me and everybody else in the room. And, of course, it doesn't stop there. It continues around the planet and in the whole cosmos. And so that specific web, it's not just one web. It's one web within a web within a web. It's a bit more complex. But it's made in such a way that certain intersections of this web are what we call black holes. So there's big black holes, and there's smaller black holes, and then mini black holes. And what happens is that when you are at a black hole point, you are pretty much in resonance with all of the black holes within this structure. This is, again, laws of physics and quantum mechanics. But these are even just the law of resonance, which is not so, I mean, this is very much validated already, and it's out there. Because you are at a specific point in space that is kind of equivalent or similar to another, it's whatever information is in one place is also in the other. And so you could be somewhere at a black hole or at this intersection point that I call within this cosmic web, And if you are at one particular black hole, you are pretty much at all the black hole all at once. So if I'm somewhere, let's say, on Mars or on a bigger cosmic level, and there's this perfectly organized web structure, and I am at a particular intersection within this cosmic web, at this particular black hole, I can instantaneously appear at another black hole here on the Earth. So it's not propulsion. You're not kind of like, you know, you know, breaking through the barrier of sound and all that stuff. It's instantaneous, and that's how it works. And it makes a lot of lot more sense anyway than the science that's out there. Do you agree?
I think it's interesting. It's hard for me to agree to any of it because without really, you know, knowing. But it's an interesting concept. And one of the questions I thought, was it hard for you to get people of science involved in a movie like this?
Actually, I was looking for, of course, scientists who of a certain credibility and caliber, I want to say, because there are a lot of scientists out there who are doing all sorts of stuff in their garage, not to diminish what they're doing, because that's how you discover amazing things, too. But what I'm saying is, for the purpose of this film, because I was trying to bring credibility, I wanted to get those guys. And surprisingly, I was able to, you know, the top scientist, I mean, one of the top scientists, a Harvard Smithsonian astrophysicist. I mean, how much more credibility do you need, right?
Was he the one that was talking about the black hole?
Yes. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? There's questions in the chat room about that.
Yeah. And so he's the one who was able to validate what I just mentioned to you. And he's one of the first people who actually not the first, but more recently, I want to say, that showed that black holes had a strong magnetic field. And so so that's his word. In fact, he's a black hole expert, so to speak, in astrophysics. And so what he's done is that he was able to demonstrate that this magnetism on the surface of the black hole is what allows information to be stored, to be trapped within the fabric of space. So everything that we're doing right now, so when we are speaking, we are projecting ideas or whatever we are actually doing is being stored literally within the fabric of space. And this magnetism, is the one that allows all of the different black holes to communicate with each other. And, you know, so the information travels through quantum waves from one black hole to another instantaneously because of the magnetic force of the black holes. So it's kind of like you have a magnet here, a magnet here, a magnet there, and all of the magnets are kind of sharing the same information. You have the quantum waves going through the magnets all at once. You see what I mean? That's how he explained it.
Can you repeat, someone wanted to know in the chat room, can you repeat the name of the astrophysicist from Harvard? What was his name?
Yeah, Dr. Rudy Shield.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Yeah. Yes, I know that name, actually. Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so, he was able to, you know, to demonstrate how the waves, the quantum waves that are, you know, propagating through space are, you know, are trapping this information, are storing information. And then you can literally use this magnetized property of the black holes to kind of be everywhere at once and transport yourself from one point to another thanks to this black hole magnetism. So, oh. Yeah.
that's something. So back to the question, you wanted to get people of a certain magnitude. Was it difficult to get people to commit to this type of movie?
You know, so he was one of my first one that I really wanted to have because he was his specialty was black holes, and me, I like I mentioned, my background was more consciousness and understanding the mechanics of consciousness. But at a very young age, I also understood that the role of black holes is not just so that stars go in and explode and disappear. Black holes are also kind of a central point. One of the things is that they hold matter together. And matter and the physical universe starts with a black hole, through a black hole. So anyway, long story short, I knew that the role of the black holes was extremely important for consciousness, understanding consciousness, but also communication, teleportation. I mean, I understood that role, the role they had. So I wanted an astrophysicist who really worked on that. And so I had my eye on him. I couldn't reach him for a long time. And so I don't know what he was doing. And somebody introduced me to him. And then I didn't hear for like 6 months. And then all of a sudden, I sent him an email. I said, hey, this is what I'm doing. This is my background. And he wrote me right back. He said, I'm in.
Wow.
And so, yeah, so that was him. Gary Nolan, same thing. We told him what we were doing, and he said, fine. Glenn Ryan, who did the experiment on the human DNA, which we probably should talk about a little bit.
Yeah,
he, when I told him what I was doing also, it was a no-brainer. Right away, he sent me all of the papers he had written, what was relevant. We discussed what kind of experiments we could do together. And he was in. So actually, it wasn't that difficult now that I think of it. But also probably because I was looking for the right type of scientists who were open to this sort of information. Otherwise, you know.
Yeah, it can be tough. Now, you just said you study consciousness. And from what I understand, that there's never been – that's a real debatable topic, isn't it?
Yeah. Unfortunately, which I'm really surprised about, because everything is about consciousness. And like I said, for me, it was experiential. It wasn't somebody told me it's this way or that way. It just happened. And so, you know, at the age of five, and at the time, there's no internet. There's no, you know, like you don't go and kind of familiarize with yourself with the topic and get kind of gather other people's input. You're just a child, you know what I mean? And then for this information to just happen so organically and for you to open yourself up to the mechanics of the entire universe, I mean, there's a lot more that science hasn't caught up with. I mean, you know, and it's all about consciousness, you know?
Yeah. No, I think, science is more about discovery than anything else.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's so many things to discover. Things are already here, already happening, and it's just discovering exactly what it is.
Right. And also, it's all measurable. Like, I mean, it's about measuring the observable. Well, a lot of it is not observable. You know, I mean, a lot of it, you know what I mean? So there. And we know it's there because the sound waves you don't see, but we know they're there. Gamma rays you don't see, but then no gamma rays you see, but you know what I mean? So they know that there are frequencies that you cannot observe with the naked eye, but you can measure with certain instrument. But still, like, the fact that they're not observable or measurable, you know, through the physical spectrum doesn't mean they're not there. And so why can there be more that they cannot measure, they cannot see and observe quite yet, you know?
Right. I had someone on the show that was talking about the brains, like membranes, the multiverse.
Mm-hmm.
Does that come into play anywhere in any of your research or looking into this?
Yeah, actually, I wrote about this. I wrote three books. And because, like I said, that was my background. And so I did the consciousness work first before I started making films. And so the biggest discovery, if you will, or what I was really working on, and I realized that that's what I was here to do, was to understand the mechanics of how things work, but also the bigger context. In other words, how does Earth fit within a galaxy, within a multi, within a universe, within a multiverse, within a multiverse. And then so I was kind of like, how should I say, I was remembering, I want to say, because I also could, part of this understanding was the remembrance of my own coming here, so to speak, like how did I get here, and how does that fit into this body, and how do I communicate with you know, my higher consciousness? How does all this work? So with that unfolding and this questioning, you know, I was able to kind of map out, if you will, a multiverse structuring, patterning, so to speak. And it's all in my book. So that was like 15 years ago. So I did that for a while. People can go and, you know, read it in the books and my classes and stuff.
Oh, okay. We had some people send in some questions on the forum. And so I will occasionally read one to you. This one's from Carrie. He asks, do you think we are being interacted with in multiple ways, but are governed by what we can perceive by our consciousness and physical senses? It keeps going here. If so, do you think this is ETs from another planet or some form of intelligence that we don't understand?
Well, it's everything. So I like this question because it touches on so many different things. First of all, from the beginning, when you come in as a human, you didn't show up in this body. And where did this body come from in the first place? Of course, as the mother and the father. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But there is the consciousness that existed prior to this physical form. And so where did this consciousness come from? So your parents didn't make your consciousness. There's something bigger than that. So just to simplify it, let's say that you are pure consciousness somewhere in the universe. Let's say you were kind of initiated or created as consciousness, let's say at the Pleiades, okay, just to simplify. So that consciousness exists at the Pleiades. But then when you are at the Pleiades and you say, oh, look at this planet down there, planet Earth, I think I'm going to go and be a human for a while. So you bring parts of your consciousness and you arrive, and that part of your consciousness is able to take on a human form. So when your parents make up the baby shape, that aspect of your consciousness occupies, you know, takes over, if you will, that baby shape, and parts of you becomes a human. But the original consciousness has never ceased to exist. So this is one answer to your question. Part of the communication that never ceases to exist is between you as a human and your higher consciousness. So that higher consciousness, which is yourself somewhere else, this connection has never been severed. So it is continuously guiding you, giving you information, telling you what you're here to do, reminding you of, you know, what you're about, and so on and so forth. But the little one that's you is now bombarded with, you know, your parents' things and peer pressure and what society's telling you to do and so on and so forth. So the human aspect of you is now creating blocks and fears. So when you are receiving information from your higher consciousness, your fears are kicking in, your confusion is kicking in, and you think you are separated. You think you're all alone, and you think you're not being guided, and you don't know why you're here, and so on and so forth. So this is when you have other entities, you see, where there are other beings that also exist within this earth plane that are now trying to help or distract. So you see how now all of a sudden you have your higher consciousness that's supposed to be helping, but then you're confused, you're, you know, pushing it away. You have other beings telling you what to do, but you don't know who's talking to it, so on and so forth. So you see how it becomes kind of confusing. So we are influenced by all sorts of stuff and beings and consciousness all connecting together.
All right. Well, let me ask you this. Earlier, yeah. When we were first talking before the show, you talked about your little Lhasa Apso, and I talked about my Chihuahua. I love, I'm a dog lover, so are you. So how do animals, they don't have the intelligence that we have. How do they fit into this whole thought of what you're talking about?
So for me, animals are created usually to support the consciousness of a planet. So their chemistry and their electrical system are made to kind of recycle a lot of the information that the Earth needs. That's why they're usually on four legs, because they, you know, bring in the information from the Earth and out to the Earth. Or if they're flying like birds and they're working with the magnetic field of the planet. So the animals are part of the planetary consciousness, part of its mechanics, if you will. That's how they fit in. But of course, they can pick up human stuff too, energetic stuff, just like you saw in the film, what we did with the human DNA.
Someone wanted to know in the chat room if there is any evidence that all of what we're seeing is assimilation. I've heard of that theory.
Yeah. You know, I thought about that many, many times. But there's too much evidence that it is not assimilation, because you can change certain things. If it's assimilation, you would think that certain things could not be changed at will, you know? So I've had very strong and very real experiences where I could change literally some things within, you know, the physical reality, if you will. So if I have that much control, then how could it be, you know what I mean? So I'm kind of overriding the program. Mm-hmm. You see?
Yeah, I get that. So Bill wanted to know, he sent this question in. You have had experiments performed to demonstrate relationship between intent or consciousness and remotely affecting DNA. I do want to talk about that, to investigate the healing properties of consciousness. What experiments have you done and what were the results? Did you also do experiments to rule out the observed effects when coming from something other than intent? So that was part of your film. So go ahead and talk about that if you would.
Yeah, exactly. So what I wanted to do is demonstrate that it is possible to come in contact with a non-visible entity. And so because, like I said, that's what happened to me many, many times. And so I spoke with Dr. Ryan and I said, why don't we design an experiment where because there have been many experiments and research and articles written on people measuring the intent on water. I mean, so there's nothing new there. But what we wanted to do is, because we were talking about ETs and entities and spirits and stuff like that, I said, well, instead of just demonstrating healing ability and changing the water structure, can we bring an actual consciousness, a spirit entity? And he said, this has never been done before. I said, well, that's the point. Let's see what happens. And so we designed the experiment. He's working with DNA, which was kind of also very interesting. And he has DNA from placenta, from female placenta, which is perfect. And so what he would do is he would measure it as a control, as a science experiment. You have to measure it over and over and over and as a control and then do the experiment again 10 times to make sure it wasn't a fluke. So what he did is first he measured the conductivity of the placenta, the DNA, and he also measured the frequencies. And what I did was we kind of looked at it and did nothing, you know, that was a control. And then I brought in I invoked at the time it was an archangel, like Archangel Michael. And so we brought in this energy, and exactly at that time, the DNA started to register crazy, like, effects. And so, long story short, we did that over and over. And, you know, as a scientific experiment, you do on and off and on and off, so to make sure it's correlated properly. And eventually we saw a very strong correlation with the times that, I was bringing this consciousness to the DNA. And it basically shot up 400%. Its conductivity shot up 400%, which was very, very significant. That's one of the results. And we did other ones.
Yeah, I know the scientist there seemed like he was a little bit shocked about that.
He was very shocked. He was like, wow. And because it was also very fast. I mean, I evoked the energy in like a few seconds. It was like, you know, so he was very, very shocked. But we also had another result that was even more shocking. And I don't want to give away the whole film because it's kind of fun to discover it as you're watching the film. But basically, he also did another measuring, which had to do with frequency, which was interesting as well. And after the contact, when we brought in this consciousness, the frequencies also changed, but I'm not going to say how, but I mean, it was very significant. And it was, he was like, this could not have happened. This does not even make logical sense. So, and again, we did it scientifically. We did it over and over and over. So these are the types of things that I did with the DNA. And it's pretty, I mean, think about it. What we were able to demonstrate was that a non-physical entity was literally changing the DNA. So, I mean, that's pretty huge, you know. So the other experiments that were done with the intent and the healing were doing one thing, but here we're measuring human DNA literally change just through, you know, the present. Well, okay, so then in the film, people may say, well, is it my intent or is it the presence of the being? And we did other experiments, and we continue, by the way, after the film to do more experiments. But even if just people who watch just the film see whether it's me or the entity, the fact that I wasn't even touching the DNA, you know what I mean? So how did that transfer happen, you know, exactly at that time? So, but we are doing additional experiments. Now we're designing a whole set of experiments, you know, on the same basis to show, you know, what the difference between me and my intent affected the DNA versus an actual entity, and which entity and then other entities. So it's really, really exciting.
Okay. Well, we're at the top of the hour. Can you let the listener know where they can actually see this film? I mean, I looked at the screening version. Can someone actually rent it at this point?
Yeah, it's going to be out in just a few days, like October 10th, so just in a couple of days. And people can go to the website et-contact.com, et-contact.com, and then go to watch the film, and they'll see all the information there.
Okay, is it going to be on like Amazon or anything like that?
Do you know? Yeah, it's going to be on all the platforms, so people can just choose and decide what they like.
Okay, so while we're on the topic of the DNA, how controlled was the environment that the DNA was stored between experiments and all that? Was that really regular? All right, everyone. So that's it for this free part of the show. If you want to support the show, you can listen to shows such as the last one we did at Shag Harbor or any of the archives and the full 2-hour versions for only $2 or more a month. All that information is on podcastufo.com. Next week, we have my good friend, Lee Spiegel, coming up. He was on in April. He'll be back. He's always a lot of fun. So I'll see you next week, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.